The Articulate Coven is the original, unofficial podcast and fan community for Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire and Anne Rice's Immortal Universe from AMC and AMC+. Welcome to The Articulate Coven. We are your hosts. I'm Joel.
I'm Ashley.
And we are The Articulate Coven. Ashley, so much to get to tonight, because not only do we have to talk about this week's episode, but you and I left out like a big thing from last week's episode. And as soon as we got off the call and stopped record, we were both like, wait,
what about the truck scene? What about, yeah, it's like the most intimate and interesting scene, like probably in the whole episode. And we were just like, but the bombs were going off. So, and then the squishy, gross vampire man.
So and this was a big moment from the trailers that we had discussed ad nauseum previously. How and to whom is he saying me and you and me, you and me and you over and over again. Such a beautiful scene as it's laid out, but we didn't even discuss it at all last week. So let's jump into that first before we get to this week's episode. He opens it with a great line, and this is one of many examples in our discussion tonight of the wonderful writing in this show. Hard words and soft words.
I love that.
Right?
I loved that so much. That to me is like a great way to have a conversation with someone you care about. You know, I'm gonna use some hard words and then I'm gonna use some soft words, and then the person can prepare themselves accordingly. You know.
And it's so appropriate in this case too. There's a lot of great things in here, but let's try to limit this, since this isn't even the episode we're supposed to be talking about. A shit life
right.
beats no life. A fundamental way of thinking that at first glance, since we always call him the Eeyore of vampires, might not be what you'd expect Louis to say. But I think that is a fundamental point that is true for Louis in the books too. A shit life is better than no life at all. Louis.
Yeah.
Never contemplates the fire in the books, not in the way that so many other vampires do.
And he really doesn't go underground. He really doesn't like take a long sleep like anybody else. Like he's really with it and in the moment, you know, as far as we know and as far as in the stories of him that we know.
If you were the last vampire on Earth, it would be enough.
You would be enough. Oh.
What? I mean, just breathtaking to me. And the acting there is so good. Delaney is silent for all of that, basically. And it's just facial response and body response to him. And very little of that, honestly. Super subtle.
And then,
really,
you know,
really good stuff. So,
Ghost Stat.
Let's
sitting
get to Dreamstat. So Dreamstat is there. For this entire, it's you and me, me and you, you and me. But I want to call attention to the fact that they do not intercut to Lestat during that exchange. It's just Louis and Claudia. I think they are telling us, and I think that it's true, for Louis, that's genuine, this admonition to Claudia. It's him and her. If the events of this season hadn't played out as they do, Claudia and Louis would be together today. Probably not in that Dubai penthouse, but they'd be together today. I feel confident.
I would say not. Not in that Dubai penthouse.
Yeah, sure. Right.
Yeah, it's, you know, I agree. I do think it's very genuine. But, I mean, the fact that Dreamstat, Ghoststat is there is just telling us that, you know, that visage is always going to be lingering between them.
So that's exactly it. Lestat is there. For Louis, Lestat is not and never will be gone. Why is that, though? That's what I was asking myself as I rewatched that. I rewatched this scene last night to prep and make a few notes for this episode. And I'm asking myself, why is Lestat still there in love as well as in, like, remorse, right? Like, he's sorry for murdering Lestat or playing a part in that, obviously. But in this moment, why is he here? Why is he still here in Louis's heart? And to me, I think it's tied up in self-expression and self-acceptance. So a big part of this episode is what Paris does for Louis and what it means for Louis. And we're going to talk a lot about that in our episode 2 discussion. But here, I think this is a mirror of this, because Lestat's the first person in Louis's entire life that not only has accepted and loved Louis for who he is and all of who he is, but demanded that self-acceptance and self-love of Louis for himself.
Right. Absolutely. You should love who you are. You should love what you are. Exactly. Yeah. I also think he's there, like, what if, and I know he's there because of Louis. I know we see him. That's Louis's, like, hallucination or figment of whatever. But, you know, I'm sure that's lingering in Claudia's mind too. You know, that he's always going to be in the back of her mind. Is he really dead? Would Louis drop me in a second if he comes back? Am I loved? Am I needed? Am I appreciated? Am I wanted? You know, like that, when you've been somewhat betrayed by someone that you love and care about in that way, then it is really, really normal to expect it again from that same person.
Louis says later in the episode, used to chasing the wrong kinds of love or something like that. What's the turn of phrase? But that's what it calls to mind. Like, yeah, absolutely. You know, bad behavior or bad choices often reinforce future bad choices. Like you're creating a track for yourself to drive through, not a new path to blaze.
Yes, exactly. It's the on again, off again, you know, college breakup that you can't quite get out of your system.
I mean, this scene is absolutely one of those kinds of scenes that you see in the Emmy award show where they're showcasing, you know, the dramatic work over the last year. I hope that this season, the awards, all of the different awards are more interested in this content. I know as a rule they don't like supernatural stuff. I know that's going to turn off a lot of people, just like this is always going to turn off some segment of the mainstream audience just because it so centers queer relationships and queer sexuality. But at the same time, like, this is Emmy worthy work. And the fact that Sam holds his own in this scene without a word of dialogue, Delaney holds her own without, you know, more than two, three words at the end of the scene. I mean, it's outstanding. It really is. It's a great, great end to that episode. All right, Ashley, let's get to this week's episode. Do you know what it means to be loved by death? Folks, alert. We've got a long-term watch that plays out. It took 9 episodes now, but Ashley has officially gotten her wish. The title screen changes, Game of Thrones style, to include the location of the episode's primary events. So last week, we got a change from season to season, and we wondered if that was going to stay or if it was going to go episode to episode. Absolutely did. Last week, it was, you know, war-torn Europe. This week, we're in Gay Paris, folks. You got the Eiffel Tower on one side, Montmartre on the other, both visible up top. Dubai skyline remains down below, as always, so far.
Just a little treat for us. A sweet little Easter egg of a treat. I love it. I like anything that's got that kind of wee attention to detail that you're only going to notice if you're a big ass nerd paying attention. And I love that so hard.
Okay. I'm going to poo poo that idea a little bit though, because you and I are both big ass nerds that are absolutely paying attention, watching this multiple times. And yet maybe you noticed it last week. We didn't talk about it last week. I went back to double check because it's there in episode 1 as well. Under the title Interview with the Vampire, as the skylines finish building in, you know, they sort of fade in from nothing as the mouth that you're seeing in the skylines closes in on itself, Interview with the Vampire is there, and under it fades in the words part 2. Did you notice this?
No.
Okay, it's there in the titles, and I swear to God it was there in week 1 too. It was there in episode 1.
No.
Or episode 8.
I was too busy looking at the skyline.
Me too. I totally missed it. I noticed it finally in my rewatch last night. But here's my thing there. Okay, I am calling my shot. I am saying, officially, season 3, that title card, like maybe in your TV guide it still says Interview with the Vampire, but in that title card, in the episode, it's going to say The Vampire Lestat. And I think season 4 then says Queen of the Damned.
Yep. That would be, that, I mean, Short of ending the show and treating each one as a brand new thing, I just can't imagine they'd do that. I feel like they'd lose momentum or something.
So that's my thing. I'm like, maybe you brand, maybe it's all IWTV, you know, Interview with the Vampire, colon, the Vampire Lestat, colon, the Queen of the Damned. I don't know. But the fact that they have gone through such pain, we talked about it last week that they're calling this episode 8, episode 9, not season 2, episode 1. Now, TV Guide calls it season 2, episode 1. And that's the way it shows up in the AMC Plus app, et cetera, et cetera. But on screen and in all of their references on social media, this is episode 8 and episode 9. And now I realize they're also specifically referring to Interview with the Vampire Part 2. Well, next season's not going to be Part 3. I don't believe that that's going to be the case. I think they're going to call out these other novels. You and I talked about Interview with the Vampire is not even the biggest seller. Interview with the Vampire is not even the biggest seller. It was the biggest.
Right.
Obviously, it's the only one that had a... Well, I say that. That's not even true. It's not the only one that had a movie adaptation. It's the only one that had a good movie adaptation. I'm sorry, Queen of the Damned fans.
Well, we love you and respect you. We do not respect that film.
Okay. All right. So you called your shot about the Game of Thrones style intros, and you got it eventually. I'm calling my shot. Mwah. Season 3 is going to be the Vampire Lestat. I can't wait. All right.
It's coming. It's definitely coming.
Here's my controversial take, by the way, right up off top. I love this series. I'm outspoken in advocacy of it. You guys know that I do. Here's an example of something that just has not hit for me. I complained about the commercial breaks. I'm going to talk about them more because you agree with me.
Oh, God, they're
a lot
really bad
do.
This episode.
They're even worse this episode. There's one in particular that I'm going to call out when we get there. But other than that, here's another thing that just did not work for me. And I, based on the comments in our Facebook group especially, I think I may be alone in this feeling. You tell me, Ashley, if you heard this at all. I love Daniel Hart's score. In this episode, his score was great as well. But the mix was terrible here. The music is way too heavy for me, almost hard to hear dialogue at times. Like, it's never been a problem for me before this episode. I don't know what they're doing. I mean, I literally
I think it's a choice.
If I had settings that were wrong. Okay.
It's a choice.
And Daniel Malloy, not Daniel Hart, Daniel Malloy plays the music and goes, "Oh, it's a telenovela. Turn on channel 300.
Oh, he's playing that. That's the theme from Young and the Restless is what he's playing there.
Okay, so is that, do you believe that that's what they purposefully made this thing play out like a melodrama?
Okay, so I think this episode is bullshit. Everything in this episode is bullshit. That's what I think. And I'm not saying I think the episode was shitty. That's not what I mean at all. I'm saying this episode is full of shit and lies. I think that's why everything has this like shiny kind of feel to it that makes it feel like almost like dreamy. And all of a sudden, Louis is so fucking happy and chipper. Like, what the hell is happening? And the music's changed so significantly. Now it's this very like quaint, like jazzy, au gay Paris feel to it. And it is not at all in line with what we've experienced so far. This episode from start to finish played to me like a charade. The interview, the memories, the every bit of it except for a couple of moments felt like bullshit to me.
Oh my gosh. Okay. That makes me feel really, really good. I agree. I do think that is some of what we're doing here. I still would say it's almost too heavy-handed if that was their goal.
No,
here.
I agree.
The music mix was too much.
Because it is jarring.
Yes.
It's jarring. It's very, but I think that's on purpose. I think we're supposed to feel like kind of sort of like something's wrong. You know, not like something's off. Not that there's something like situationally wrong, but like something about this episode's really wrong.
Okay, so let's figure out as we go here what is wrong in this episode. Let's start with the scene at the cafe. I think this is another excellent example of these two actors going head to head. And as much praise as we've heaped on Jacob Anderson, Delaney, by the way, in this episode eats, my friend, from start to bottom.
But, she's fantastic,
right?
In this episode.
She's so good.
Yeah, she's really, really good. I think she's real. I think that he remembers her correctly, mostly. But, like, I feel Armand just all over this shit. Oh, just playing games with everybody has just fooled everyone. Everybody's too relaxed. Everybody's fucking Louis just too happy to be there. Even when he's like, we really shouldn't push it with these vampires. And Claudia's like, yeah, we should. He's still like not offering up a vehement disagreement about it, you know, like a reason why.
Yeah. Yes, I'm with you now. And even as I'm sitting here, I'm processing, oh boy, what is the goal? What is the aim?
It was hard for me to watch it a second time. It really was, because I was so like, this isn't real. This isn't real. And that, I mean, I had such a strong reaction to this episode. I loved it. It was fantastic. But like, it really just set me a little on edge because it felt so wrong.
Okay. So one of those moments that was a little off to me the first time we watched it, but Kelly called something out, my wife called something out for me to look at and watch the second time. And when I got there, I got a little chuckle, honestly. Okay. So their meet cute happens in the Dick Garden in Paris, which
yes.
makes total sense. But okay. So, but it starts out though, Armand calls out the fact that Louis pretended that he was getting by and nobody would notice him. But first of all, he's beautiful and everyone keeps calling it out. But secondly, he's strutting as he goes through the garden, like clearly an American. And they're like, how does an American walk? But then you see Jacob Anderson walking through this garden by himself. And Kelly's like, just watch his walk the second time. And Ashley, all I could think of is that man is strutting through the Dick Garden. And what a juxtaposition from season one, where he sneaks off to the bayou with his boyfriend from high school to get a little down low. And here he's in the middle of Paris and he's like, you know what? I'm looking for a little cock, actually.
I'm going to the Dick Garden. I'm going to lead with my pelvis and go straight to the Dick Garden.
Beautiful environs, don't get me wrong. Some great sound effects, too, straight from season
always.
One.
Always. Always.
I don't know. She called out the walk, and it's absolutely true. He's strutting there. But, okay, you mentioned earlier there are a handful of things in this episode that feel real. And there is a moment after they meet, and I think it's right before he says, Daniel asks, what did the ancient vampire say to the future love of his life? And before they do the meet cute thing where they talk over each other, there's a moment right there where both of them are just wistful. And that to me felt real. If you watch what's happening in the bedroom when they're alone, how far they are apart, right? How they peck,
right?
You know, Louis pecks him on the cheek and Armand clearly wants more in a way that like shows he's not getting it. And we already know that Louis is prone to sort of like celibate periods in his life when he was in his ennui with Lestat as well. So the combination of all those things, and then they come into the room with Daniel and they're holding hands and they're sitting on top of each other basically, and they're finishing their sentences and, you know, everything is glossy. But that moment shone through. And I do believe, first of all, in all of the press, everyone is saying like, this romance is real. This is a real relationship. Armand truly loves Louis as much as Armand can love anybody. You know, everybody's broken people, et cetera, et cetera. But like, this is real. Stop doubting it in one way or another is what you've heard from the press. Okay, great. In that moment, I believe that.
I'm happy to believe that Armand is super in love with Louis. And I'm happy to believe that Armand has convinced Louis that he's super in love with Armand. You know, like I buy it, but I'm not buying it like that. Also, I think there's been some discussion of the Devil's Minion in our Facebook group talking about Daniel and Armand's storyline in the books. And somebody was like, did we call that a romance? and somebody came out swinging like vehemently, like, yeah, this is a romance. Look at all these examples. And I'm like, yeah, that's true. But Armand is still doing manipulation and fucked up shit to Daniel. He's messing with his brain. He's messing with his perception of reality. Like, that is not a normal way. That's like using a love potion to make someone fall in love with you. You know, like It's manipulation at the high of its highest form. That doesn't mean that there's not, you know, doesn't mean there's not feelings there and it's not. But I just watched Bridgerton and I'm going to tell you right now, I don't think that that's a romance.
Well, I mean, okay, even if, and we've speculated, like, what if this is all by Louis's request, right? What if Louis got to a point where he was like, I don't want this anymore. You got to cut it out and asked for it. Still, if your friend asks you to cut out a part of their brain, you say no, and you try to get them help for the self-harm that they're trying to inflict is the right way that you happen, right? Like, you don't take that opportunity to cut out all the bad shit about you.
Yeah, all the shitty things that you might have done. I mean, they're erasing things that you don't like. Let me make myself out to be a really, really stand-up guy when really I am a wee murder goblin.
Okay, so last week we complained about the commercial cuts. I especially complained about the commercial cuts, I'll be honest. But on our Facebook
they're really
group,
bad.
Most people agreed that they were also terrible. A couple of people said some version of, I'm watching it on cable and there's commercials there and I don't really notice. Or I'm watching it on AMC Plus with commercials and you know, I don't notice. However, things like in this episode in particular, someone pointed out that you get to the scene where it's right before the final piece of the theatrical performance and the narration says the only story that mattered was the last one, and it cut to a Burger King commercial instead of cutting to the scene where Santiago, you know, kills the girl. There was another
That's really
moment,
jarring. Right? It's like when you're watching like a really intense documentary and on YouTube and like something really stupid comes on.
Oh my God, yes. So, okay, so this is the example that I wanted to call out this week. Claudia's first Madeline scene of the series, which was great, I thought. But this is a perfect example of just terrible placement for the commercial breaks. Like, never mind the fact that the black is too long or they inartfully chop it in or whatever. But, like, this is just not the place to take a scene break, folks. Claudia is opening the door of the shop, heading in after she's warned against her by the shopkeeper across the street. He kind of waves and just says, don't bother with her, ma'am. And then she goes into the shop anyway. But that's where they put the commercial break. When you come back, she's just inside the door. She's gone through the door. Like, you don't cut to black in the middle of that. Just keep the scene going. Either put the commercial before the Claudia scene or after the end of that before you cut to her with the dress.
It's kind of like a lot of television producers, directors, editors. Well, I don't want to say editors, but I mean it literally is their job. Have gotten out of the habit of editing for actual like network television with commercials. And now that so many streaming services are starting to add ads back in, you know, it's like, well, y'all got to get back into the habit of knowing where the cuts need to happen, knowing where the break needs to be taken, because it is something that can add to the tension and the way, an episode is driven. You can definitely use those ad breaks to your advantage if they're done, you know, done with a little art.
Yes, exactly. Done with a little art. That's the key. Like, I mean, for God's sakes, there's like 70 years of TV at this point, and all of it had commercials until very recently.
Until very recently. Though, I mean, I think it's just one of those things that like, is that something that new editors are even taught, or is it like, you know, old dead coding, like, you know, COBOL and things like that, that like schools don't even teach anymore.
I mean, maybe, but I'm saying like Murder, She Wrote and Columbo are out there. You can go watch them online.
It's
right
very
now.
True. You could be a student of the television history, by God.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get to the theater. The set design is fucking amazing. This is every bit as good as the house from season one.
It is. It's very, very good. I think in one of the you know after show special things that they did, they talked about, or I might have read it, but that the reason why they decided on Prague to film in this season was because of that space. Once they were able to. They saw that space. They wanted it. Once they were able to procure it for the season, they were like, all right, Prague it is. Here we go.
Yeah, absolutely. That was in the episode Insider at the end. It was like a factory, I think, previously or something. So it was
big, God, they did
space.
Such a good job with it.
Just outstanding. Okay, let's just give him his flowers for a minute here, and I'll let you start. Ben Daniels.
Please and thank you, Santiago. How I love to hate this character, and I love to hate him the most I've ever loved to hate him right now, currently in my life. Ben Daniels is so fucking good. He just oozes Anne Rice vampire, does he not?
Excuse me, I was chewing. Yes. I was like, let me eat an M&M is what I'm going to do, actually.
She'll probably talk for a minute.
Not only that, no, not just that, but like, seriously, Ben Daniels is so fucking yummy in this. All right, so
let me tell you. It's ridiculous.
And forgive forgive me if somebody else has said this already. I didn't see it in the comments on Facebook, and I was honestly so excited that I might be the first to say something about it. How much is he taking inspiration from the MC from Cabaret? He opens this thing.
Oh.
And he's just Joel Grey, right? It's fucking fat. He's welcoming, basically,
it's
right out the gate.
Very, yeah. And even his costume design is, I mean, I think that had to have been a bit of an inspiration across the board for him in this iteration of the character. I fucking love it. I love him. I can't wait to see what else happens this season, because he is intense. He is giving off smolder and danger and cheekiness. I loved it. That was a brilliant piece of casting.
So he does this thing at least twice where he has both of his arms up with the cape, and it is like, so the perfect, it looks like the poster from like the Dreadpenny Opera, or like one of those posters of the original Universal Dracula or something. Like, it is so perfect 1940-ish vampire, right? Like,
yeah.
Oh my God, it's amazing. And that's all before he cuts out the charm and puts on the vampiric power and makes chills run up and down your spine, because you're like, not human, something scary, gonna eat
something,
me.
Something's wrong, but I'm gonna let him eat me anyway. It's like, you know, you can tell with him that he is dangerous. He is very dangerous. I mean, I wouldn't let that guy get within a county mile of me if I could help it. But then once he did, I would be so screwed, because you would not be able to, like, I think his powers are very, yeah.
Okay, it is almost hard for me to believe that this version of Santiago was allowed to exist and continue under Armand. Like, he's so charismatic and so powerful and so frightening. Haven't there been power struggles? Like,
well,
Armand is,
I think,
not...
it's more like he's the front man, you know, like he's the front man for the band. And Armand's like writing the songs, essentially, you know, like he's the front man. Armand's the producer. That's kind of the vibe I get. And so I think that that's probably why they haven't had a power struggle. Though, I mean, obviously we're going to see that come to pass. I would assume in the next couple of episodes, we're going to start to see more of that as he starts to push against Louis.
Well, and there's at least sort of like a little hint towards some of that. Maybe Armand says to Louis, or Armand says in the narration, I couldn't hold the coven back forever.
You know? Right, right.
I mean, and they are, what's he going to do? I mean, I guess he could just kill them all if he wanted to. He could probably set them on fire, honestly, but maybe he's not going to pull out that trick exactly.
Well, and it's kind of set up that the danger, speaking of that, that the danger is that, oh, the coven was kind of iffy about you guys because you've been in town for so long and didn't make yourself known to us. The proper thing to do when a vampire comes into town is to go find the other vampires and introduce yourself. Have a little tete-a-tete. But apparently that's not what was done, obviously. But that's, to me, just, again, a ruse, because we know Lestat has made his way back and has told them about Louis and Claudia and what they did.
So I wonder, is he already in Paris? And we're going to get to a specific scene about that. You absolutely think he's already there. He's
yes, 100% he beat them. He beat them there because he went straight there.
Well, can we
as
talk
opposed
about,
to?
Can we talk about the two idiotic vampires that don't go to the Teatro de Vampire two blocks away from where they live? How
right,
does that genuinely
that's been
how does
around
that work?
For 150 years? Yeah, morons. If you're really looking for vampires, why aren't you looking there? Maybe it's because they're working too hard on survival. Like Claudia's really miffed that it's harder to live there. They don't have as much money. She has to steal more. So maybe they're not paying it. It's not on the radar yet because they haven't gotten comfortable enough living there where they can live like they used to live, you know?
Okay. So, after the show, Armand brings them backstage downstairs.
Show, by the way.
Oh yeah.
Holy
yeah.
Shit.
Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the projections for a second. Good call.
Oh my God. That was so fantastic. Like,
I love that addition. Changing the time periods. It makes perfect sense for this crew to be enamored with projection. First of all, we already know our vampires like movies. They think it's a good, you know, in this interesting what humans are doing these days. So it would make sense that this group would be able to incorporate, you know, film projection into their onstage performances, and it looks lovely and otherworldly and goofy, but also unsettling, weird, as Louis puts it.
Right, absolutely. And it's really like they talk about them being old plays that they've kind of, you know, retooled for the current times and things like that, which is just very true of theater, television, whatever sort of books, whatever sort of entertainment you enjoy. It's very much same stories that have been recycled in different ways throughout history. I love all the vampire tricks that they're able to use and disguise as not being preternatural or supernatural. You know, the fact that he's really flying, but they make it look like he's rigged is hilarious to me. Like, I loved that move. And the projections are really cool because that's also something we're starting to see more in modern theater as well. That's something that's being utilized in, you know, a lot more often.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Okay. So as they go downstairs, though, after the show, Armand's taking them backstage and he begins to sort of like, I mean, it sounds like he's taking them on a tour, basically. Right. And he goes into, they've been a coven since Charlemagne reigned, so maybe as early as the late 700s, but they've only been a theater company since Danton was guillotined. George Danton was killed on April 5th, 1794. I looked this up. So,
oh, excellent.
The end of the 1700s is when the theater company started, but they had been a coven before that for maybe 1,000 years.
Right. They've been hanging out.
All right, so a theory that I had based on the watch of the episode, but it turns out a couple of other people also were wondering along these lines. What do you think the chances are that Bruce is actually made by Santiago?
Oh, man, I think pretty high. Like, I the chatter that made a lot of people think about it was the motorcycle scene. You know, they all go on the coven all goes on a hunt together. They take Louis and Claudia with them. And that sort of puts you in mind of our motorcycle bad guy. Definitely puts you in mind of him. And he said he was from Copenhagen.
Yes. Yeah. He said that Copenhagen is where he was. He got sent to Copenhagen to work, I believe. It wasn't a military. Maybe it was military. I think it was just a job. But either way, he was in Copenhagen, and that's where he met the vampire and got turned. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think it's really dangerous. I think that there's a lot of, like, red flags being waved. And Claudia is just too fucking excited that she has found a place where she doesn't have to be ashamed of herself, where she can be a part of something, that she can actually fucking feel like she belongs to something for the first time. And it's all just a fucking nightmare underneath, and she has no idea.
So, to me, the very first moment when they ask about that, first of all, I want to call out because I didn't notice this the first time. Santiago asks who their maker is. Do you both have the same maker? And then when they're like, my maker, he says, oh, she does star charts, but she needs the time and the date and your maker. And he cuts her off because she says,
I don't need the maker.
Yeah, she starts to say, I don't need the maker, and he cuts her off. who's your maker? And so calls it out again. And then when they say the name Bruce, again, like, I mean, maybe they're just all reacting to the name Bruce. And then he makes the quip about, oh, is he Scottish? But
right.
I thought, to me, there's that moment, there's just a brief moment where Ben lets it wash over his eyes. Oh, really? My boy, Bruce? And then when she says further that he threw himself on the fire, I feel like there's a very, again, a telling reaction if you're at a poker table from Ben Daniels again right there. And so to me, I wonder if the start of the trial, if not the finish of the trial, if the start of the trial is actually not about Lestat at all, if it's actually about Santiago's beloved offspring.
Oh, that'd be interesting. That's certainly possible.
All right, we already called it out, but I love when Daniel turns the tide on them to begin with here and calls BS, throws the flag and says,
so funny.
It's the young and the restless. No, it's a telenovela.
Jesus Christ, that's how I'm feeling this whole fucking episode. Like, everything is so, to me, like, saccharine and over the top, and, like, all of a sudden they're really, really, like, physically showing out. Like, we've not seen them be physically close at all really yet, and now, you know, aside from some hand holding and things like that, now all of a sudden, like you said, they're on the couch sitting super close together, like legs entwined, hands entwined. It's just such bullshit. If I am Daniel Malloy in that moment.
So right after this, we get, again, if you're going to submit for the Emmys, this is maybe the scene for Delaney. Claudia's got a fantastic scene as she defends herself against Louis for mentioning the name Bruce. Kelly called this out on her first watch too, though. Delaney lets her accent slip a little bit there. There were a couple moments we joked about Tom Cruise's Irish Lestat.
Going a little Irish.
Yeah, Delaney goes a little Australian almost, it sounds like, in a couple of her deliveries there as she's trying to maintain the Southern. But the emotions are so raised, and like her... It's like excitement for this new life that she's been exposed to, the indignation that she has with Louis calling her out for this, like, what he considers a slip. And she's like, what the fuck was I supposed to do? You don't ever make a choice in public.
Right. And you certainly were going to speak up. You weren't going to fucking give him an answer.
You just going to stand there and go,
Lestat?
What, my master?
Think about Lestat in your brain.
My maker, you mean? Oh, me? Who, me? The other Louis? Who you talking to? Anyway. Okay, so that was a fantastic scene for me. And again, like, I already liked Delaney's performance better than Bailey last week.
She just has so much hope.
Yes.
That's what's so sad about that is that, and she's so angry and upset. And it's because she has hope, finally. And God bless, she doesn't want it to be taken away from her, you know?
Can I say, though... She could have gotten so much of this from Lestat in New Orleans.
Well, if Lestat acted like he fucking liked her, come on.
He
was very dismissive of her.
Okay. Yes. All right. There was I'm reminded now suddenly of the scene where he takes her out to Lover's Lane and like points out that she's never going
to
have.
Yes. That is, you know, mean to her. Relationship. He's mean to her.
But I mean, like, you hear what she likes so much about Santiago, the joy of the kill. These people enjoy being vampires, et cetera, et cetera. And
they're,
I'm like,
proud.
The Brat Prince is your maker, friends. Like, what? You want to talk about somebody who enjoys being a vampire?
He didn't enjoy being a vampire with her. These people would let her be a vampire with them, she thinks, you know? He loves being a vampire. He didn't really like her.
Let's take odds on how this goes for Claudia. What do you think?
No, it's not good. It's not good for my girl. Never is. Bless her heart.
So going into it, as they started it and I realized what we were about to get, I thought the Roger scene with the lawyer was going to be a big mistake. Louis never interacts with Lestat's lawyers or business apparatus or anything. And the other thing is, I immediately started telling myself, now, wait a minute. Lestat always has these like complicated passphrases and keywords and things, code words that he can use because he has to surface every 40 or 60 years sometimes and reclaim his fortune as his great grandson or whatever. Right. So
recreate himself. In a way.
So, okay, cool. But once the box comes out and Roger steps away and I and the hand comes out, and I was like, oh, this is a way to get Sam to deliver another, you know, wonderful moment with Louis. This moment is full of so much. The letter is beautifully written. Again, like, if you want to, this is not straight out of Anne's work at all, but this is these writers doing a wonderful job at imitation, because this is in her style 100%. It's the way that she would write this sort of note from Lestat to Louis. And to me, I couldn't walk away from that scene without going, oh, Roger has absolutely been contacted by Lestat. This paperwork, this box was delivered post-attack. Now, I don't know that Lestat is in Paris. I still don't know that I agree with you necessarily there, but this box came from Lestat after they tried to kill him. And I guarantee you it didn't come without instructions from Roger. That is the reason to me.
Let me know when he comes and gets this. Hello.
Yes, exactly, exactly. Louis now, Lestat knows exactly where he is. That's why I don't think he's in Paris necessarily, because he doesn't know inherently that that's where Louis is going to go. He has a guess, because it's one of those cities around the world, and Louis already mentioned it. It was mentioned as a possibility in the first season. So, like, it's on the radar. He talks to his agent there, and my guess is that Roger's agencies all across the world probably have similar packages and similar instructions. But this guy was reticent in his dealings with like, why didn't he just come out, Mr. Dupont de Lac? Of course, we've been expecting you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, no, he played it coy and made Louis sort of stumble over himself about his relationship with Lestat and what it was. I think because he knows this motherfucker tried to kill the dude that he and his company love.
Try to kill my boss, man.
Our beloved client, Mr. DeLeoncourt.
Our beloved client of centuries. The reason why I think he's in Paris is because I know he needs that blood from Armand. And I think that would drive him to Paris first and foremost to get that, to start feeling better, so that then he can deal with the situation at hand if he wants to with Claudia and Louis. I really do think his intention was never for that coven to go after them. Or if anything, like, maybe they could take Claudia off Louis's hands and he wouldn't have to deal with it. But I do think that because he went there for help and said what happened, that's how things start getting real out of hand.
Well, okay. To me, I mean, the whole thing plays out like that in my head anyway, but the specifics of the letter, I think Lestat is taunting him with it in the letter. He says, if you're in the event that you're reading this, something dreadful has occurred, which is not my own death.
Right. We're separate. We're living in separate worlds.
We live in two different worlds now. Yeah. And so to me is like, I don't think he's in Paris yet. I think he's still in that. Well, I mean, maybe he's not in the new world. Here's the other thing too. Like, Lestat at this point thinks he knows where Marius is, maybe. I mean, depending upon where we are in the books. So, like, maybe he's gone to search for Marius and Akasha and the ancient blood.
Maybe
to really
so.
Heal him. So anyway, I don't know necessarily that Armand's his first tick. We'll see. I think we'll see very, very soon how this plays out. But that scene to me, absolutely, I'm glad now in retrospect that it's in the show. I think it's a wonderful moment, and it really gives us a lot of speculation as we move forward, keeps things fresh. But at the same time, like, when we went into it, I was like, oh, wait, this is a change I'm not going to like. Okay, the confrontation of Daniel by Louis. So earlier, Daniel calls them on their bullshit, and it's the telenovela. And then eventually, he pokes one too many times, and Louis comes out swinging and ends up giving him the tremors. And between him and a couple of jabs from Armand, they completely kowtow him. But it ends with Daniel saying what happened next. And both Armand and Louis respond to it almost with nods. And Ashley, I didn't even realize it the first watch, but the second watch I was like, oh, we talked last week. Is there some information that Armand and Louis are trying to ferret out of Daniel by rehashing his memories, et cetera, et cetera? I think it was literally their goal to bring him to heel. And I mean, Armand says, we'll have him saying what happened next, as in just fucking ask the questions and listen then.
Right.
And that's exactly what they get him to say. They push him And he goes, I'm sorry. What happened next? And what they both are next? Like, yes, exactly.
Now you're on the right track with us. So what do you think about Alice?
Okay. Can we kick that to the end of the episode? Because it's
absolutely
a speculation in a way that I'm a little bit worried about spoilers.
Big speculation station.
There's one other thing along those lines that I want you and I to talk about a little bit, since we've both been spoiled.
Excellent.
Okay, so let's...
A
little bit of spoiler discussion at the end of this episode. Okay.
Yes. Okay, excellent.
So that confrontation from Daniel, though, was like really powerful, and I think is telling. I don't think there's some secret that Daniel knows and they don't. I think it was literally just, let's take back control of this interview. I think that's what Armand was saying the other night in bed.
Well, and that might have been the whole thing with this episode. I could be totally wrong about it being bullshit. It could be a power play. It could be something is disingenuous about it, you know? And maybe that's it. It was like, we got to get this shit back under control ASAP, because this is not a boy we're dealing with. This is an actual grown ass man with problems.
Let's talk about the murder mansion.
Oh my God. I love this. This scene was so fantastic.
Okay, so it starts off in a really interesting way that maybe we had seen in one of the extended looks at the show. I don't remember this from the trailers, though. I'm not sure. Armand, they pull up. First of all, the drive there is very cool. And yes, as you mentioned earlier, absolutely reminds us of Killer from the first season. But here, Armand pulls up, turns around, looks at his coven, and reads out the crimes, basically, of the inhabitants of the house that they're approaching. And again, it's at least the implication is that this coven tries as often as not to hunt the evildoer.
Yeah. It's a house full of rich assholes. Let's eat the rich, shall we? Yes.
I mean, like, not just
that assholes.
Let's be honest. If they were prospering. Yes. If they were prospering at that point in Paris, they were Nazi sympathizers and probably... Yeah. Cooperative as well.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, these are not fun people.
So Assad's great in the whole series, let's be honest, but he's really good in this scene as he lays out the dangers for Louis. First and foremost about their potential relationship. It would be tricky. You know, coven life is hard, but then, which is interesting because it's sort of in opposition to what he explains to Daniel later, where he's like, I fucked that one and the other one and I fucked those two one night too. It's just what you do in repertory theater,
which is funny.
A real chuckle out of that too, by the way.
Oh my God.
Very true as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of mixing and matching backstairs in theater.
People get slutty backstage. I met my husband doing a show.
Well, look, here's what it comes down to. And you and I have spoken about this before. Theater people fuck around with theater people. Theater people marry theater people as a rule, because you don't have time for a social life outside of your group. You're there in the morning. You're there late at night. You're there weeknights. You're there on weekends performing. And it's like, if you're going to hang out with somebody, you got to hang out with somebody who's on the same schedules. So that's the way that it works.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right.
Where are you going to meet people?
But it's not just that he lays out the dangers for the relationship. He also points out that you got to get better at guarding your thoughts.
Yes.
Now, he says here in this scene that he doesn't know the nature of his association with Lestat, but he could feel that there was something. He knew Lestat and wasn't excited about talking about him.
And that he needs to guard his thoughts if Lestat's name is mentioned again.
Yeah. That was interesting to me. And I thought he did a good job of laying it out like that, but it's like, okay, can they not read each other's? I mean, Claudia acts like she's just scoping everybody's mind out. And we know she's not that powerful a vampire. So is Santiago not capable of reading all their minds? If you're right, and Lestat's already in Paris, do none of the rest of the coven know it? Is Armand the only one that knows he's there?
Well, I think it's really clear that Santiago has some sorts of mind gifts with the way he's able to calm and manipulate the young woman that they're killing during the show, you know?
Yes, 100%. Right, which wouldn't make sense to think that they're both able to shield themselves from him, I would think.
I do love this, like, calm conversation that they're having that also has pretty high stakes, even though they're like, they're very calm in this conversation between the two of them. They're very like suave flirting. Meanwhile, just fucking bloody murder and mayhem is happening in the background. It is like on par with the Manson family.
Okay, so my favorite one is they cut, the camera swaps, and you see the couple in the foreground and the front garden of the house in the background, and there's a vampire chasing a human. They go behind a bush, and when he comes out from behind the bush, the vampire is alone holding something, and then a headless body sort of wobbles out behind him and falls down. And as the vampire goes away, you hear, "Thank you!" He snatched the dude's head. Right? It's hilarious. It's like a bloody version of the Three Stooges all around in the background. It's fantastic.
Yeah. They said shooting that, they were like, "You just go in there and act like vampires, guys."
Okay. So again, an excellent episode. I feel like the way they finish scenes and the way they finish episodes is not nearly as artful as in the first season. And maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think that immediately upon conclusion of the episodes, they cut to trailers. I think we got credits for a second, you know, and a little bit of music at the end of an episode.
That cut was really jarring.
Yes, you don't feel like the episode's over, and then suddenly they're giving you something from next week.
And I was like, what the sh... What? Yeah, that was and it's like, yeah, there's like 9 minutes left in the runtime of it when that happens too. So it was really, really confusing. Even though knowing there's a like behind the scenes thing happening at the end, I was really, really confused.
Yeah, me too. So there's at the top of that trailer, though, I will mention this because several people commented about it in the thread to make sure they had heard it right. Armand does say it was 1556, and then he starts talking about, you know, whatever the rest of the quote is. I think it's literally two separate pieces of audio put together. I think he's going to be telling maybe about his origins or when he joined the coven or something like that. And then later in the timeline, he and Lestat meet. If the theater didn't start until 1790s, then Lestat and he can't have met in the late, or, you know, in the mid 1500s. That doesn't make sense.
No. And Lestat's not that old,
no,
is
he's
he?
Not that
1500?
Old. No.
Yeah, no. That timing is not right at all. Even with the time changes, that timing is not right at all.
Right. When he meets the coven, it should already be the mid 1700s or late 1700s, honestly. So, yeah, I think we've actually already heard the year in season 1 when Lestat was supposed to have been made. So, we'll see that play out. And we're going to see it play out next week, by the way. Okay, so I'll be honest, I have not enjoyed season 2 as much as season 1 for lots of these little nitpicky reasons. And also, I know my baby boy is not in it as much as he was in season 1. So, like, that's been a hamper for me, I'm sure. He's going to be in it a lot next week, looks like.
Yep. It looks like we're going to get a lot of eye candy next week.
Okay.
Some characters we've been waiting for.
Oh my goodness, so several characters that we've been waiting for, and that's some of the things we're going to talk about in the spoiler section in just a second. One more thing from the episode itself, though, or actually from the episode Insider, I just want to call this out. All right, several people have now commented in our comments either on YouTube or in Facebook as well about this. Where the hell is Rollin Jones? He's not in these episode insiders, and he's so great at doing this in an artful way. I like Mark Johnson, the executive producer. He's clearly made a lot of great TV, but his parts in these episode insiders are a waste of time. He either doesn't understand the episodes well, or he can't explain himself. I don't know, but twice now he reads the title and then explains it, but it's on such a surface level. I mean, it right. basically means nothing. I don't understand what they're doing there. Rollin was excellent. Adam O'Byrne is fine in this one. But, like, Rollin was giving us stuff in these episode insiders last year or last season. Are they holding him hostage or something? Did he do a boo-boo like Bo DeMaio on X-Men 97? What's going on, Ashley?
Please blink twice if you're being held hostage, Rollin. We're looking for you. We're wondering where you are. Are you with the head of Scientology's wife? Are you with Shelley Miscavige somewhere? I think you're being held hostage, and we're quite concerned.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about a couple of spoilery things.
Oh my God!
So the first one was from this trailer. What, or the second one was from the trailer. What was the first one that, that you were about to talk about earlier and I cut you off? I honestly have forgotten now suddenly.
I have two. Shit on a shingle. It
was. We were talking about, was it, it wasn't the Roger scene. It was...
It'll come back to me. Oh, no, it was Alice. It was Alice.
Alice, yes. You asked me about Alice. Okay, good call, good call. All right, so we mentioned earlier the question on Facebook about is the Devil's Minion a romance? Are we considering that a romance? Like, yeah, I mean, listen.
I mean, it is. It's a romance. It's just not a nice one.
No, right? It's a
not a healthy
story,
one.
A long story of Daniel and Armand's lives. And there are, in the later books, other stories of those two characters as well. So, like, that story is not all just in that one chapter. A big portion of it is. And a lot of people wonder, are they going to incorporate that into the show? And if so, in what way? All right. In this episode specifically, during that attack from Louis on Daniel, we get a glimpse where he sees Assad as Armand out of time. His hair is clearly different. They're in a different location. Fairly certain that the light is recalling the San Francisco room, right? I think this is the interview room is where they were when this is happening. And you see Armand, but don't hear him at first. And then when it flashes the second time, you see and hear him. And he says something to the effect of, when you were in eighth grade, you stole your father's Playboys and sold them to your friends at recess.
Yes.
Okay. That scene and this broader question of the relationship with Alice, which has been brought up many times now. Erica Robert Paolo, I think she had this theory last season, actually, but has expounded
really
upon
interesting
it
theory
this year as well. She believes that Alice is entirely a fiction. The relationship with Alice is code because of parts that they've rewritten in Daniel's memory, and Alice equals Armand. If you're a Game of Thrones fan, let's do the R plus L equals J or whatever.
Oh, right.
You know, so this is that, right? This is it, Alice is just Armand. And the one moment in this episode particularly that I think gives the most credence to that is when Louis is on this attack and kind of poking fun at Daniel because Alice turned his proposal down. Armand jumps in and says she wanted to say yes. You hadn't
she
given her a reason to. She didn't trust you yet. You hadn't given her a reason to trust you yet. And okay, everything else, first of all, I'm not convinced that either of them are ever reading Daniel's mind about these relationships. My thought has always been they were there and were observing him from afar and just know these things that happened. But that couldn't be read out of Daniel's mind, right? Like, if Armand knows that and said that with that confidence, I guess theoretically they just implied that they could find out what she thinks about him now if he wanted to know. So maybe Armand scanned from her mind from afar and got that information that she wanted to say yes. But like that, I think that's a stretch. It read to me in that moment as if Armand was saying, I wanted to say yes, but I didn't trust you. You hadn't given me reason to, you know, it's a little bit of softness.
It's a very interesting theory. I wouldn't have bought it last year. I didn't buy it last year, but I'm very leaning into it at this point. Just because the only thing is that I'm trying to, he says he has daughters, and that's the only thing that I was like, oh, was Alice the mother of his children? And if that's the case, then that must have been a real thing, you know? But I know he has multiple ex-wives as well, it seems like.
Okay, so he does say in this scene, or they say in this scene, I think Louis's the one that actually uses these words, but they say something about Alice being in her third trimester.
Trimester.
So she was not only pregnant, but was laid in a pregnancy. You wouldn't imagine there was an abortion decision at the third trimester, right? So like,
no,
this would have been
that's not a thing.
I mean, right, exactly. So if something had happened, maybe still that story might still end in tragedy. But the implication there to me was that at least one of his daughters is from that first relationship. Now, again, Erica thinks not only is Alice really Armand, but maybe the reason why his daughters don't speak to him anymore is because the daughters don't exist.
Don't exist. Yeah, that's definitely possible too.
I mean, it would be weird. It would be very weird to me if one of the revelations about our, at least theoretically, two of our heroes of this series are that they rewrote a quote unquote happy ending for a guy, except it wasn't, I mean, he's alone in this happy ending. He's got a, you know, a debilitating disease and no family and a fading career, you know?
Right.
Like that's not, I mean, maybe that's why they've circled back. Cause like, hey, what we thought we were doing didn't play out like we wanted it to. I don't know.
Well, yeah. And maybe it's like what you said, like they want to bring him back into their fold. They want to heal him. I mean, it could certainly be that. That would be a lot less nefarious than some of the other things I've thought about.
You're right. Right. Okay. So, all right. Here's spoiler two. The soundtrack is out. Yep. You can get it on all the streaming services. I think you can even order a physical copy now if you want one. But like going back to my senior year of high school, the Phantom Menace soundtrack for Star Wars.
Yes.
One of those
tracks.
The track
noble death of Qui-Gon.
Right? Like what the fuck,
the noble
fuck,
death
Lucasfilm?
Of Qui-Gon.
Come on, man.
So I was literally listening to that a few days ago and thought about how funny that was.
So that's exactly what we got here, basically. It's not a funeral announcement, but there is a track. And again, spoiler, there's a track.
There's
on
two tracks.
Thing. Oh, see, I only know about the one. I guess I've kept myself from one. All right.
Good.
But you know about both of them, so I'm not going to spoil something
believe,
for you. Okay.
No. Oh, no. You. No, I've already been spoiled. Come on.
All right. So the thing that I understood, the thing that I learned without wanting to, was that one of the tracks is named Raglan James.
Yep.
Raglan James is the name of the body thief from the titular Tale of the Body Thief, the fourth novel in this ongoing novel series. The speculation is that, contrary to what we all thought in the preamble, Justin Kirk, coming up next episode, it looks like maybe,
yes,
is not actually going to be playing David Talbot, which we had speculated previously, but instead is going to be Raglan James himself. And I, the speculation that I've read in our comments and elsewhere is that he may be, in fact, the lead of the upcoming Telemasca show that's in pre-production.
Interesting.
I mean, Raglan James in the novels was, in fact, Talamasca trained once upon a time, right? That sort of happens before the adventure and before we get to know him in any of the novels. But the idea
that's
that he
true.
Exists out there and is doing something is not against the novels. It's
no.
It's all, it could totally work. He just hasn't had his run-in with our vampires specifically yet.
Yeah, that's really... When I saw that, I was like, what in the fuck? Are we going to do things real the fuck out of order? Like, how are they introducing him now but they're not introducing him in that way? They're not introducing him as the way we know him as the body thief.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I think that's true. Do you want to know the other one, or do you want me to keep my mouth shut?
I do want to know the other one now. Go ahead. Let's talk about them all. Let's unroll them.
Track 12 of the first disc is called Amadio.
Oh my.
Yeah,
oh my.
which is Marius's name for Armand.
So do you think we're actually going to get Marius this season?
I don't know. I think we might at least get a story about him.
It would be weird, honestly. It would be very unlike this show to do a scene where we shoot around him and we don't see a face or something like that because they haven't cast the actor. That doesn't strike me as what they would do. And I mean, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility that they have a surprise name for us.
I did not see when I had, well, so I of course. Clickety clicked right on the link and was like, oh, what's the soundtrack look like? Oh my. And and saw Raglan James immediately and was like, ah, close it. And then because I'm a fucking glutton for punishment and I'm the kind of monster that will watch shit out of order because I am a creature of chaos. I got into the comment section on our Facebook group and somebody was like, yeah, an Amadio. I was like, oh shit. Oh shit.
I mean, that is very exciting to me. That is, and we do know, Rollin Jones talked about when they would let him do episode insiders. He mentioned last season that the vampire Amon, the novel, was one of the novels that he required his folks to read when they were leading up and working in the writing room. So, like, it makes sense why they would begin to pull in those stories so early. And I will say, like,
well, he's been mentioned. Marius has been mentioned. So it's not like
yes,
they're going to write
yes.
him out completely. That would be ridiculous to mention him. Can you imagine what an affront that would be to fans? Like, you fucking put his paintings up as like an Easter egg, but we're not going to get the character at all. Oh, we would riot. We would burn shit down.
Well, and the quest for Marius is so central to Lestat's story in particular that I think it's, if we're going to get much of that next season, then it makes sense that we get glimpses of where this is going. I mean, we speculated about the season might end. The big reveal at the end of the season might be Akasha and Inkle. Well, if we're going there, who hangs out with them, guys?
Yeah. How can we go there without Marius? You know, like, I mean, for thousands of fucking years, that's skipping. That would be skipping too much of a character to me. I would have a serious fucking problem with that.
So how would you feel about getting to know Raglan James as a quote unquote hero, or a, you know, a protagonist anyway, before he becomes the antagonist in that adventure that's coming down the road?
I fucking love that idea. I'd love to get to know him a little bit more and know more of his journey, what led him to be who he was. The other thing is about Tale of the Body Thief is just, to me, fun. It's just really fun adventure. It's fun to read. It reads really fast. There's not as much angst and like misery. It's very fun and interesting. Everyone's just getting into shit and shenanigans. And it's like a little breath of fresh air after all the heaviness of Queen of the Damned. And I think that's really can be super fun to like get to know this guy a little bit more in a different context. And then when he's like, you know, jumping into people's bodies, we can, you know, deal with him as the villain that he becomes.
Well, okay, so that's the thing that I spent probably the most time on this particular theory idling about this week. And I will say, I got a particular kick out of thinking about Justin Kirk doing a Sam Reed impression trying to get laid.
Oh my God, it's so funny. It's like in Harry Potter when they broke into the Ministry of Magic in like the last movie.
Hermione pretends to be Bellatrix.
And Hermione's pretending to be Bellatrix. So you've got Helena Bonham Carter pretending to be
Emma Watson. Pretending to be yourself.
Pretending to be Hermione, pretending to be fucking Bellatrix Lestrange. It is. I love that. I love anytime that's happening, anytime there's sort of mixed up characterizations like that, I always have such a fun time watching that. I think for actors, it's such a cool, fun, crazy challenge.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of all the Freaky Fridays, so bring on more. I'm down for it. I will say this. I like Justin Kirk as Raglan James a lot better than Justin Kirk as David Talbot. And I was okay with that. I like this better.
Right. I think it's going to be really fun. I think it could, potentially it's going to be very fun. I think that's great casting for that character.
Also, the glimpse that we get of him in this week's trailer for next week is him saying out loud with Daniel in the bar. It looks like he says the Great Convergence? No, what is it? What are they calling the thing Armand referenced it in season one?
Yes, the it's like,
I'll have to look something it up. That it's the great something.
Convergence? Is that no? I think it's not convergence.
No, it's not convergence, but it sounds like that. Anyway, he references that, and it, I mean, again, like it fits if you think about it. Like, boy, this sort of like, suddenly the vampires are doing something that they've never done before, and what's going to happen here? That would be a moment where a character like Raglan James might say to himself, well, let's try something different here. You know, a little unscrupulous. He's been going along mostly toeing the line, skimming off the top maybe or something from the Talamasca. And now he's like, actually, let's hang it out here and see if I can get a vampire body.
Yeah, I've got some special skills I'd like to play with. And they have special skills I'd like to play with.
Yeah, I'm very much looking forward to seeing this. Yes, okay, he did call it the Great Convergence. We were right. Louis refers to it in season two, and then that's what Justin Kirk says in that trailer. The Great Convergence, it's really happening. So I don't know, man. I'm excited to see where this is going. I will say, currently, the most interesting part of this series to me is happening in Dubai in that living room, even though Santiago's doing these amazing things on stage. Overall, the backstory, because I don't know what to believe, if I'm being frank,
right?
It's harder for me to commit and really fall in love there.
Yeah, we have no clue. That I think that that's in a world of unreliable narrators, we are drowning in a pool of confusion.
And scene. That's I know when to close the show. Okay, drowning in a pool of confusion. If we're still floating next week, we'll be back with another episode here. Hey, real quick, programming note, I will say. So I was on the road this past weekend with my daughter for a gymnastics meet. We are going to be on the road again from June 4th to about the 14th or so. So we'll have some odd recording during that. But Ashley and I were pre-gaming before we got on here tonight. We are going to record during that period. It just may be a couple of days late, just like we were today. So stick with us and continue giving us great feedback on the Facebook group and in our YouTube channel. We appreciate all of that so much.
And if you need to kill some time, I would highly like to recommend Bridgerton, because like the monster I am, I started with season 3. Because I like Nicola Coughlin so much.
Okay, so is that the lead?
I watched Dairy Girls. Yeah, she's the lead in season 3. Okay. She's Penelope Featherington. And I have loved her for years because I watched Dairy Girls, which is also a fucking brilliant, hilarious show if you haven't watched it yet. But yeah, so I was like, well, fuck it. I haven't watched the first 2 seasons. I'm going to just start with the 3rd, which I got to be honest, that's how I did Lost. I watched the series finale, then I went back and watched it. So like I've been known for this type of fuckery before, but of course I also have been known for my hyperfixations. So I've already watched what they've put out of season 3 twice, and I'm on my 2nd viewing of seasons 1 and 2. So yeah, it'll pass your time.
Okay, so I literally asked a friend of ours from college, Jessica, who is already a big Bridgerton fan. I commented on one of her posts the other day about it. Like, listen, I've not been really... I mean, I was sort of intrigued. People say, oh, it's a sexy period piece. And like, it's really quite sexy, actually. You should watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I felt I've been that a little way intrigued. About... That's exactly me. And I do like shit from the Regency period. I love Pride and Prejudice. It's one of my like top 3 favorite books. Like I love things from this time period. It came out during COVID at first and I just wasn't feeling that. I was like, I needed grimmer shit to.
But Ashley, you know. They started hitting me with these Facebook ads and these Instagram ads.
Yeah.
And it is this delectable little curvy redhead. And like clearly she's centered in the show, and the whole season seems to be about getting her good and fucked and married off to the love of her life is my guess. And I'm like,
it certainly is.
Yes. Yes, sir. Thank you very much. Actually. Yes, that is my particular shit. Yeah. So anyway, I'm going down that train myself.
Curvy
now.
Redhead. I highly recommend, you know,
well, this I mean, is, I'm married to one. I'm very fond of him myself.
Right. Exactly. It's good times for everybody. I have to say, I think that, it's good times, y'all. Get in on that if you haven't yet.
And oh,
it'll
hey,
be something
front,
you can watch during the off season.
On that front, and I hate that this wasn't earlier in the episode. I should have called it out in the moment, but I want to call it out here so we don't forget it in the future. There was a big difference in the Santiago scene in the theater from this episode to the 94 movie that I wanted to refer to specifically. In that seduction of the young girl, when he takes away her screaming and pain and calms her and then eventually feasts on her and gives her to the coven, what we don't see that is in the movie is in the film, he disrobed her and forced her to the audience front, right? We get bare breasts.
Yeah.
In a very exploitative, confrontational way. We don't have that here. He promises her no pain and delivers it, honestly. And it's still tragic and it's sad and it's scary, but I just thought that's a good example of that wouldn't have been consented nudity. Like the nudity that we've seen even from sex workers, like
it's been fairly positive.
And that would have been forceful, inappropriate. I say inappropriate. I mean, like, you know, who decides it's inappropriate. But to me, that would have been in a negative light, even from these, you know, murder and vampires. I thought it was good. I think it was a choice made and I like it.
That's a very good call out. Yeah. That whole scene was fantastic. She was so scared. My God, I think she's someone's assistant.
Yeah, she was the director's assistant, they said. I mean, primarily she's an actor, but but that is, right. is one of her gigs. Yeah.
Her side hustle. And she was so fucking scared. I was very into her performance.
Yeah, she's really good. I also love how several times in the episode, the coven forces somebody to speak English. They're like, no, 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 in English.
Oh, I do love that. In English, my English troop. I love that they explain that too, like that it wouldn't make sense that they're using English like that. They're in Paris, why would they not be speaking French in the shows?
You so I love that bunch kind of explanation. Expats and servicemen, yeah. that are still in town, and so yeah, you do a show that. 5 out of my 7 shows a week are for them or whatever, you know. That's
who's coming
fantastic.
In well, we Americans do love that kind of thing.
Ha! That's well. We strut down the Dick Garden to
yeah.
See
we strut
fancy theater.
pelvis first through the Dick Garden.
Oh man! All right, we'll be back next week. Until then, we are your hosts. I've been Joel.
I'm Ashley,
and we are the Articulate Coven. Thanks for listening to The Articulate Coven. You can join our community on Facebook by following the links in the show notes or searching for Articulate Coven on Facebook. You can subscribe to the show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at articulatecoven.com. And share us with your Anne Rice-loving friends.